I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Jacob Hornberger from the Future of Freedom Foundation. He's its founder and president, and he writes every day at fff.org/blog. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you, Scott. Doing fine. Thank you.
Great, man. Happy to have you here. Lots of stuff to cover today. First of all, are you running for president as the Libertarian Party candidate or not?
Well, let's just say that I'm contemplating the possibility. I've gone to, I don't know, 7 or 8, 9 state conventions in the spring to kind of get the lay of the land and to deliver a talk on my philosophy. And the title of the talk is Adhering to Principle is Everything. And so I'm contemplating the possibility to answer your question.
All right. Well, can you give us a time frame of when we might expect to find out?
No. But I mean, you know, keep in mind that this political cycle where people announce a year or two in advance is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, by the time, you know, January rolls around, everybody's all burnt out and bored and so forth. I mean, when John Kennedy announced for president, he didn't do it till November of the preceding year. That was what was just standard. And so there's really I don't see any reason why any of these candidates are announcing now as compared to November, December, January. There's no reason for it at all. I think people get sick and tired of this kind of endless running for president that goes on in this country.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, but I don't know. It seems like all the other candidates are already in it and are running and things like that. So,
well, anyway. As you know, timing is extremely important in this game. Yeah. And I'm contemplating the possibility. Like I say, I've been to several state conventions, given talks, interacted with a lot of people. I found it a very rewarding and gratifying process since I started doing that last spring.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good deal. Now, first of all, let's talk about trade, because I want to talk about immigration, but I also want to talk about trade. And I think trade is more immediately in the news here. And I'm a couple days behind on the news, but you may have seen where Trump was tweeting, "I hereby order American corporations to come home from China, to bring their manufacturing home from China." And then later his staff clarified that, oh, yeah, no, I mean, he can't order people to do that. He was just saying that he's ordering them to look into it or something. But anyway, he said, "We don't need China." Essentially, they're more harm than good with all the intellectual property they steal and the rest, and that we're better off without them, and they're putting on some new higher tariffs up to 30%. At the same time, he's saying the Federal Reserve better lower interest rates in order to stimulate the economy. At the same time, he's putting on the Smoot-Hawley tariff and trying to grind as much of it as he can to a halt. And I don't know. I just figure I'd let you start talking about that. How's that for the form of a question? Do you have anything to say?
Because you hit the nail on the head. I mean, this guy's trade war really, I think, says so much about Donald Trump. As I put in my blog post of today on Monday, he is a democratically elected dictator. And now people sometimes think, oh, well, in a democracy, you can't have a dictator because he's democratically elected. But that's not true. You can elect a person and then vest them, or they vest themselves with dictatorial powers, and that's what he's done. And you're absolutely right. When he said that he was ordering everybody, all American businesses, to get out of China and to stop doing business with China, it was out of anger because the Chinese are not bowing to his dictates. And so they're retaliating with tariffs of their own. And so he got angry. And in his peak, he said, man, I'm ordering you guys to get out here. Like, he's the commander in chief of the American private sector. Well, he's not. And he's just the duly elected president, but he thinks he's a dictator. And while his staff may have tried to walk that statement back, he didn't. He actually cited the law in 1977 that Congress enacted that delegated unconstitutionally and illegally his power to do this type of thing, as long as he cites the two magic words, national security. And Trump even said that. He says, look at this law. I do have the authority to do this. Well, this is classic dictatorial conduct, and it's not the only time he's done it. Notice that he just raises these tariffs. He started this entire trade war, Scott, on his own. Now, we live in a system, a governmental system, where Congress enacts the laws. That's the way it was intended to be, including tax laws. And a tariff is a tax on the American people. It's a sales tax on imported goods. And he didn't go to Congress and say, hey, would you pass this law imposing tariffs on the American people? He just unilaterally does it himself. He does the same thing with sanctions and embargoes, like on Iran and North Korea. This man is showing how far this country has gone in the direction of dictatorial conduct.
Yeah, but he's going to save our economy. Or maybe.
It's interesting you say that, because that concept that the president's job is to manage the economy is so ingrained in both Democrats and Republicans. Now, notice the Democratic response to this, especially among the presidential candidates. You don't see them really going after him on this trade war. I mean, they may throw a little barb here and a little barb there, but they're not going at him at a liberty level, a fundamental level that says Americans have a right to travel wherever they want and trade with whomever they want. That's the essence of a free society, which necessarily means unilateral free trade. Liberate the American people to travel and trade wherever they want. Well, Trump is over here saying, well, I have the job as president to be the elected representative of American businesses. Well, who elected him to be an agent of businesses doing business overseas? Nobody elected him to do that. But that's the mindset of both he and Republicans and Democrats. So the Democrats are sitting back saying, oh, wow, the economy's starting to falter here. And they're taking the position now that they would be better managers of the economy than Trump. And Trump's getting desperate because he sees that a recession is on the horizon here. Well, the real question is, why should a president be managing an economy? Why can't the president just leave people free to manage their own economic affairs? That's where the libertarian philosophy comes in.
Hang on just one second. Hey, guys, I got to tell you about WallStreetWindow.com. It's the great Mike Swanson. He made a killing on Wall Street back in the day, and now he sells advice for reasonable prices. You need to know what to do to protect your assets. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, guys, I know you're going to love Will Griggs' new book we just published at the Libertarian Institute, No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. It's wonderful. It's terrible. It's devastating. You'll laugh. You'll get angry. You'll miss him. You'll be inspired to fight for freedom. With perfect cover art by Scott Alberts and a brilliant introduction by Will's great friend and protege Thomas R. Edlam, it is a fitting legacy for a brilliant man and nearly tireless defender of liberty. Get No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg, in paperback or Kindle on Amazon.com. All right, now, so here's the deal, though. Part of the reason that the American people hate the Bush-Clinton post-Cold War consensus is because of NAFTA and GATT and the WTO and the most favored trade relationship with China and the giant sucking sound to places where labor is cheaper and Americans losing good-paying blue-collar jobs. You know, because we went from a pretty protectionist system to not much protectionism almost overnight. It was really a shock to a lot of people. And They never had a choice before. This time they actually had a choice, and they elected a guy who was against that. In fact, I think if the Democrats had nominated Bernie Sanders, who agrees with Trump about trade with China in many ways anyway, representing the labor union, also the supply side here, not the consumers, I think he would have beat Trump because he had that one big issue in common with Trump, but without a lot of the other baggage. The rest of his baggage was, I promised to give you rich people's money. And that probably would have gotten him elected, unlike Hillary. But anyway, so there's a huge backlash here. I mean, that's how he got the job. There's a huge backlash against this free trade because guess what? You know, Chinese peasants will work for cheaper. They always will. But Americans want that job. So what about that?
Okay, we got to go back to fundamentals on this thing. And the fundamental is, what does it mean to be free? What is the nature of a free society? And a free society is one in which people, at a minimum, have the right to engage in economic enterprise to sustain their lives, occupations, vocations, entering into deals with other people, trade, because you can raise your standard of living with trade, and then accumulate the fruits of your earnings and then decide what to do with them. Now, as a libertarian, I am totally opposed to NAFTA and GATT and all these agreements. I mean, they're like 10 inches thick, and they call them free trade agreements. Well, I guarantee you, if you've got an agreement that's 10 inches thick with a bunch of rules and regulations, that is not the libertarian ideal of free trade. When we talk about free trade, we're talking about don't negotiate anything with anybody. You don't need to sit down with a president of another country and say, let's work this out. You don't need to engage in these trade wars. All you have to do is just liberate the American people. That's all you have to do. Release all your own restrictions on the freedom of the American people to travel and trade wherever they go. Does that mean that other countries will follow suit? Well, some of them will, because they'll follow by example. They'll see the higher level of prosperity that free trade brings. But even if they don't, if their governments continue doing the types of things that the U.S. government does today, subsidies to favored businesses, protectionism, tariffs, so be it. That's something for American businessmen and American tourists and American consumers. They have to ferret out for themselves how to deal with foreign countries where there's bad things happening. But it's no business of the U.S. government. So get rid of all these so-called free trade agreements. Get rid of these meetings, high-level meetings to negotiate these things. Get rid of the trade wars unilaterally. Lift all trade restrictions on the American people. Liberate them to travel and trade with whomever they want and wherever they want to go.
All right. Well, I wonder, though, if this is going to help crash the economy that Trump is trying so hard to, you know, keep inflated. When he ran, I'm not saying he's any kind of Austrian, but he is a real estate guy. So when he was running for president, he said, this is a giant bubble. This Obama economy is fake and all of this, which was true. And now he owns it big time and claims credit for every, you know, good sounding statistic that comes in. And yet he's been very critical and has done probably more than any president a long time to, you know, publicly politicize the Federal Reserve. And where here he said, I don't know if you saw this on Twitter, he said, my only question is, who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Z? And his problem is they won't inflate. They had another meeting and they did all capitals, nothing, exclamation point, meaning he wanted them to cut rates further to stimulate more inflation. He's got an election to win here, and he's terrified that the whole thing is going to fall apart before November 2020. But at the same time, he's the guy who's waging this trade war and trying to, I don't know to what degree, but to some pretty significant degree, shut down trade with our biggest or second biggest, compared to Canada, I'm not sure, trading partner there. So I don't know. You got any predictions?
Oh, it's fascinating that you know, remember, for the first 2 years, all we've heard from Trump and his supporters is that he is responsible for this great economy, the stock market soaring, unemployment rate down, that isn't he a great manager of the economy? Then he starts his trade war with China, And I'm sure he thought of that it was going to be over in about 2 weeks, that the Chinese were just going to buckle, and which was sort of what the Mexicans did when they renegotiated NAFTA, which turned out to be not much different from NAFTA itself, the new agreement. I think he thought the Chinese were going to do the same thing, and he was going to look like this hero. And now it's clear that the Chinese did not buckle, and you're right, it's now throwing the whole world in the direction of a recession, and he's panicking. And so what is he doing? He's not saying, well, this is because I've been a poor manager of the economy. He's saying this is the Federal Reserve's fault because they won't lower interest rates. And what he wants them to do is what presidents have wanted them to do since the Fed was established in 1913, and that is inflate these bubbles to create artificial prosperity. And that's what the Fed's been doing for the last 10 years since the big crash in 2008. They've been inflating this bubble. And that's what brings these booms and the busts. It has nothing to do with free enterprise and everything to do with Federal Reserve policy. And yeah, Trump's politicizing it. Now, you know, we're told that the Fed is independent, but we know that's not nonsense. You know, everybody in Washington succumbs to political pressure. And so the Fed now is starting to really inflate this bubble even more. So we've got this situation, as you point out, he's got his variation of the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which was enacted in the midst of the Great Depression, which made the Depression even worse. So we've got this trade war at the same time that it looks like a recession might be on the horizon based on what they call the inverted yield curve in bond sales. And then he's over there asking the Fed, keep inflating. And by the way, let me keep spending money. I mean, he just made a deal with the Democrats to lift the debt ceiling again, enabling the government to spend $1 trillion more every year. We've already exceeded $22 trillion in public debt. And get this, Trump and the Democrats make a deal to extend the debt ceiling conveniently till after the election so that neither one of them can use it against the other. I mean, this shows you the joint corruption, Scott, of both of these parties. They're both complicit in the destruction of liberty in this country and economic prosperity, genuine prosperity, not the Fed-induced bubble type of prosperity to which we've become accustomed.
Yeah. You know what? I wonder how things are going to be after the next crash. I don't know. It seems like people keep saying that, you know, the next one will be the worst one of all or something like that. But I've heard that before. But it does seem to be that they get worse and worse if you go and if you look at, say, 88, 92, 99, 08, they do seem to be more and more disruptive. And then you look at the amount of money that they've created and the amount of intervention that they did after 08 here to see what the real correction and unraveling of all of that looks like is, I don't know, beyond my immediate imagination, but I'm betting it's going to be pretty ugly.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, they are bigger and bigger, and because what they do is they encourage malinvestment. They artificially lower interest rates. So a business is going to say, hey, wow, business is booming. Interest rates are low. I'm going to go out and expand my business. But then as the reality starts to set in, after the business has incurred a bunch of debt and he realizes, gosh, there really isn't enough consumer demand to sustain this, that's when the recession hits. That's when the shakeout starts. And they never want that shakeout to start because, you know, that's bad for political business. So they start inflating again. And so you get this malinvestment piled on malinvestment. And what I said many, many years ago is that, you know, we've seen various sectors that bear the brunt of this in a big way. Like last time it was the housing market. That the value of everybody's houses just cratered nationwide. And sometimes it hits the stock market. But the prospect that I've raised many years ago is, what happens if one of these days the sector that gets hit is the banking sector? Now, you know, the FDIC has enough money to take care of 3 or 4, maybe 10 or 20 bank failures. But what if there's an industry-wide banking collapse? Where is the FDIC going to get the money to cover everybody's insurance? And notice that they keep raising the insurance. It started out as, I don't know, $10,000, then $50,000, $100,000. I think it's $250,000 now, maybe more. And it's all with this notion of, oh, don't worry, we can cover you. Everything's fine. Well, they can if there's a few banks that go under. But if there's a nationwide banking collapse, what are they going to do? Tax everybody in order to give everybody their money back? So I think that's a possibility. And if a bad one comes, and you know, I'm not here, you know, saying a predictor of doom, but I know that the Great Depression hit. And if a bad one were to come, what people have to anticipate is that this government's going to be very, very vicious. All governments are to get their money. And the government's going to want money, even in the Depression. And so in the 30s, President Roosevelt actually nationalized gold. This had been the official money of the American people under the Constitution for over 100 years. And he just said, I don't need to go through a constitutional amendment. This is an emergency. I'm taking everybody's gold from them. And he made it a felony offense. Everybody had to go to the banks and turn in their gold. Well, over in Argentina when this happened, the president of Argentina seized everybody's 401k and retirement accounts and replaced them with government bonds. And I think that is a likely possibility if there really is a big recession in this country, the seizure of people's retirement accounts and their replacement with bonds, because that's exactly what the Roosevelt administration did with gold.
Crazy, man. I guess Hummel and Henderson, they say that if it comes to, you know, total, you know, massive inflation, destruction of the currency, in order to prop things up, that instead they'll just repudiate the debt before they completely inflate the dollar out of existence. They'll prop it up by just screwing every bondholder, which I think is probably the best solution. If people invest in government, they deserve what they get. Although, yeah, I guess if you're saying the government just took their gold and replaced it with a bond, and although that was back then, but I hear you.
Yeah, I can't imagine them just outright repudiation. My feeling is that they would inflate, because the inflation is repudiation. I mean, it's paying people back in debased dollars. But the average Joe Blow American doesn't realize that the government's doing it. And so he sees prices rise and he starts blaming it on profiteers and price gougers. And he has no idea that this is what happens when the government debases the currency. And let's face it, they've already destroyed the currency. I mean, you know, there used to be still silver dimes and silver quarters circulating in this country, but they inflated the bad currency to such an extent that those went out of circulation a long time ago. So they've been playing this game for decades. Both parties have. It's not just Trump. You know, people keep going after Trump, but it's really not a Trump issue. It's a systemic issue. It's something that both Democrats and Republicans have done by creating a central bank, the Federal Reserve. Remember, America lived without a central bank for over 100 years. They went to a paper money standard, which was contrary to what our country had. They went to the income tax. They went to all these statist programs, the welfare state, the national security state. And now they're spending out the gazoo, and they're really sending our nation into bankruptcy. And along with these dictatorial powers that they vest in the president, that have really changed the character of American life. They changed the governmental system, and that changed the society itself.
Yeah. Now, so let's talk about this immigration piece that you wrote earlier. This is something that divides libertarians a lot. You have this one particular great paragraph I wanted to highlight here, where you talk about, you know, there's a reason that libertarian advocates of immigration controls never mention the problem of enforcement. And then you go on to cite a lot of, not just the current crisis with, you know, the massive number of people being held in these temporary prisons and all of this stuff, but all of the rest of enforcement that comes with living inside the constitution-free zone of the 100-mile, which anyone can just type that in and look at the ACLU map there. It includes both coasts, or all three coasts too, and a 100-mile buffer zone in from Mexico and Canada. It happens to encompass about somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of the population of the United States of America live inside this constitution-free zone, where in the name of immigration enforcement, the National Police Force can run roughshod over the constitutional rights of all of us. And anyway, you elaborate here in this article real well, and it, you know, really brings home the idea. And why should libertarians especially be the ones to fall for this, that somehow, Your opinion about what the law should be is a magic wish that's just going to make everything fine rather than just giving a bunch of cops an excuse to hurt people.
Yeah, it's a police state that they've enacted, an immigration police state. And this is what libertarians who support the idea of immigration controls never address. And I underline the word never, that they come up with these esoteric arguments as to why libertarians should join up with the Democrats and the Republicans and support immigration controls. But the central core principle of libertarianism, as you know, is the non-aggression principle. It says that people should be free to live their lives any way they want, so long as they're not initiating force or fraud against another person. So the mere act of crossing a border on a government road or a government bridge doesn't violate anyone's rights. I mean, people cross the Potomac River, which is the border between Maryland and Virginia, every day. When they cross that border, they're not violating anyone's rights. And the same applies to an international border. When somebody crosses an international bridge, he's not violating anyone's rights. And so in order to keep out these immigrants, they're violating that libertarian non-aggression principle. They're initiating force to keep somebody from engaging in purely peaceful behavior, or as the Declaration of Independence says, pursuing happiness. And but people, if they just issue the law that says no entry allowed without permission, nobody would obey it. And because that's just not the way life works. People cross borders to go seek a better life, make money, improve themselves, pursue happiness. So they have to enact these enforcement measures that increasingly fail. And so they have to finally get to a point where they've enacted a police state. And that's what they've done, Scott, in the American Southwest. As you know, I grew up down there. I grew up in Laredo. I saw this police state firsthand. I mean, I grew up on a farm on the Rio Grande. The Border Patrol could come onto my farm without a warrant. If we put a lock on our gate, they would shoot off the lock. They would come in. They never came into our house to search the house, but they would go down, they would in their Jeep or vehicle all the way to the river and search for illegal immigrants without permission. And this applies to the whole 100 miles, as you point out. That's two-thirds of the American population where they have the authority to do this. Now, most of the time they're doing it near the border or on the border. But you have roving Border Patrol checkpoints. You have highway checkpoints, Scott, that run on highways east-west, stopping people that have never entered Mexico. And these are subject to full searches. I mean, if they want to, they can search your body cavities if they want to. They search your vehicle. If they find any contraband, they seize it and charge you. This is the type of thing that exists in totalitarian countries. In Florida, they're boarding Greyhound buses and asking for people's papers. And if somebody's dark-skinned and doesn't speak English well, like in my hometown, 20% of the population doesn't speak or write English. At least that's the way it was when I was there some 40 years ago. Well, those people have to carry their papers whenever they're leaving Laredo to show that they're American citizens. That's not a free country. That's a police state. And that's what this socialist system does. And immigration controls is a socialist system. It's based on the principle of central planning, where government officials are centrally planning the movements of millions of people in a very complex labor market. So that's why you have this chaos and this crisis. You have thousands of people packed up at the border trying to get in. Meanwhile, you got farms in the United States where the farmers are letting their crops rot in the fields because they can't get the people to pick the crops. That's what socialism does. It produces what Ludwig von Mises called planned chaos. There's only one solution to it, and that's open borders. Nothing yep. else is going to work. And you know, people get shocked and say, well, Jacob, that's a radical idea. Well, it may be a radical idea, but it's the only idea that works. There's nothing else that works except the free market.
Okay, except here's the thing of it. There's so many. We're not talking about individuals and, you know, husbands taking their wives and children and getting on the boat or hiking and whatever, kind of sort of a few at a time. We're talking about mass immigration. And so, you know, in a sense, it's not really violence, but it's kind of coercion. It's kind of force. If all of a sudden in your neighborhood there are, or your part of town or whatever, there are tens of thousands of new people who are coming and whatever. I don't know. People react against it. I don't give a crap. But anyway, you know that it's a problem. from the point of view of a hell of a lot of people who are reacting against it and are hiring the government to protect them from it. So, I mean, is there a point where, even if it is all Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's fault, where enough of the population of Honduras just wants to all move to Texas where maybe they can't? Half of Honduras can come here, but not the whole country, or I don't know.
Well, you're right to point out that foreign interventionism is a primary cause of immigration to the United States. The United States is the U.S. government has initiated coups and revolutions and other acts of violence in Latin America that has just turned these regimes into cauldrons of anger, rage, hatred, violence, shootings. And then there's the drug war that does the same thing. So you got those two things that have caused a lot of the people to want to leave. So if you stop those two things, if you stop the foreign interventionism and the drug war, then things would start to return to normal so that the immigration flows would be more normal instead of like a mass exodus of people. But even that, even if we have those kind of programs and there's a lot of people coming, the idea that everybody's going to come to the United States is really fallacious. The reason is because it is extremely difficult for a person emotionally and financially to just pick up stakes from a country that he's living in, that he's accustomed to, the language, his friends, his family. It really is a rare kind of person that says, I'm going to leave it all and I'm going to come to the United States. And those are the people that really turn out to bring this vitality and this energy. I mean, they're sort of like a God's gift to a society. But you have to rely on laws of supply and demand to regulate this. And this is what people forget. You know, for example, in California is a nice place to live. I mean, it's a beautiful state, beautiful scenery, mountains, oceans, and so forth. Why doesn't everybody suddenly move to California? Well, because it's extremely expensive to live in California. You know, the cost of living is higher, the taxes are higher. People are actually moving out of California and moving to Las Vegas right now because they're selling their houses at a high price and they're getting the same house at a third the price in Las Vegas. This is the laws of supply and demand. We notice we don't have any restrictions on Americans to move wherever they want. Theoretically, every single American today could decide to move to New York City. Okay? I mean, I think we'd all agree that New York City is a pretty overcrowded place. Well, since that danger exists, should we enact immigration controls prohibiting Americans from moving to New York City? Of course not. The laws of supply and demand take care of this. It's extremely expensive to live in New York City. So most Americans are going to say, well, no, I think I'll just stay here in Montgomery, Alabama, or Charleston, South Carolina, or Dallas, Texas, because I like it here, even though New York has a lot of nice things to go visit. So that's the same principle internationally. It works on a country. It's, as people start coming in, prices start rising, the price of housing, the price of everything, and then that discourages others from coming. Now, you're right, though. Culturally, people don't like change. Remember, many people don't like change. I mean, I like change, but you know, they see an influx of Hispanics into a community, and they say, oh my gosh, this is changing the nature of our community. There's signs in Spanish and so forth. Well, that's what comes with a genuinely free society. It's that diversity, that change. But I should point out that there's a lot of communities in the South now that have been revitalized by these Hispanic immigrants. In fact, even to the point where when the Immigration Service, the ICE, went out and started making these violent raids on American businesses, I think it was in Tennessee, that a lot of people rallied, Caucasian people rallied around the Hispanic immigrants. They were working in those businesses trying to prevent ICE from taking them away. So in a free society, is there change? Does it bother people? Yes and yes. But the idea that we should sacrifice our freedom for the sake of some kind of security net is a pretense anyway, that all you end up with is tyranny. And so you give up both your security and your freedom, and you end up with neither.
You can hear the Scott Horton Show and Anti-War Radio on Pacifica, 90.7 FM, KPFK in LA, kpfk.org, APS Radio at apsradio.com, the Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org, and of course, check out the full archives more than 5,000 interviews now going back to 2003, and sign up for the podcast feed at scotthorton.org. And thanks. All right, let's talk about this one. Why no congressional investigation into Jeffrey Epstein's intelligence connections? What an obvious and yet unique question. Jacob Hornberger?
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. And I know, you know, there's been a bunch of conspiracy ideas, theories, and so forth that have been going on around his death. But the one that I focus on is the statement by Acosta, the assistant U.S. attorney, who cut the deal. It was a sweetheart deal. I mean, this guy was charged with federal trafficking of underage girls. And he ends up with this sweetheart deal that where the feds agree not to prosecute him, which was shocking, and he pleads guilty to a state charge of soliciting a prostitute, which was really an insult against the underage women that he was bringing into his fold. And then they put him in a local jail where they let him out every day to go conduct business, and then he comes back and spends the night. This went on for about a year. Well, when everything hit the fan about this agreement just recently, they were asking Acosta about why did this agreement come into existence, and he made this very cryptic remark. Supposedly, he said something about, well, there was an intelligence factor involved here, something words to that effect, referring to some intelligence agency or intelligence force or whatever. So we don't really know exactly what he meant, but it was such an intriguing remark that my question is, why isn't Congress investigating this? Because the implication is that some intelligence force brought pressure to bear on Acosta to drop the federal charges and let the guy have this sweetheart deal at the state level. Well, if that's the case, if some intelligence agency, whether it's the CIA or the Mossad or some other intelligence agency, Navy intelligence or whatever, is corrupting our federal judiciary, then isn't that something Congress should be looking into? I mean, when you have a judiciary, you have to rely on the fact that it's honest, that it has integrity to it. But if some intelligence force is able to influence them in some corrupt way, that's something the American people are entitled to find out. So I wrote that article saying, why isn't Congress investigating this? Now, this is totally separate and independent of how he died and what he was doing with these girls and the lawsuits that the women are now bringing. This is just something that I think affects the American people directly. Is there a corrupt judiciary here, and did it become corrupt because of some intelligence force as manifested in this particular case? Because if they did it in this case, Scott, they can do it in any case. Yeah. And I think it's incumbent on Congress to get to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm.
Well, and in this case alone, the implications are vast, because if he was working for intelligence agencies, what was his work? Obviously, blackmailing powerful people into committing the same kind of crimes he was into, right? Nobody thinks he had another job than that if he was working for spies. And so that's why, you know, it's amazing to see, right? Bill Richardson and George Mitchell and the prince, all these people named, and it's not proven that they did anything, but I'm prepared to believe the worst about Bill Richardson, for example. But this guy had a lot of powerful friends for a long time, and, you know, there are quotes from people saying that, yeah, of course he had his whole island wired for sound and video and all of these things, which only makes sense, right? Had Bill Clinton lied about how many times he was on his plane? Oh, I was on his plane 4 times. Oh, that's funny. You're in the records 27 times, including trips to Thailand. Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure that was just business. These guys. So, yeah. And, you know, as far as conspiracy theories, I think the one where he killed himself is a conspiracy theory. But anyway, not that I, you know, I, in fact, just speculation wise, Bumper, do you have a favorite between he's still alive somewhere versus, you know, he was throttled to death by somebody's hitman?
Well, let me first address your first point, because I think that's really an important point. I mean, the speculation was rife on the Internet that, and not in the mainstream press, interestingly enough, was that this guy was running a blackmail operation. And they were quoting traders on Wall Street saying, "We never traded with the guy, and here he is running this hedge fund." And so the speculation on the internet was that what he was doing was luring these people to his parties and then having them go up to the bedroom with these underage girls, which I'm sure he probably led people to believe were 18, and then videotaped them, and then contacted the person the next day and said, "Hey, I've got this hedge fund. How about investing $5 million in it? Because, hey, we got pictures of you here." And so the person would invest in the hedge fund, and of course he'd never see his money back again. And so that was a fascinating theory, and you know, that's something that I think still should be explored in these civil lawsuits that are being brought. Because if that's the case, Scott, the point you make is very important. Why would an intelligence agency, regardless of who it is, want to associate with this guy? I mean, here he is trafficking in underage girls. Why would they want him? What, to spy on what? You know, spy on the Caribbean or what? Well, we know what J. Edgar Hoover's modus was. I mean, this is no conspiracy theory here. Hoover would keep files on people. He would discover dirt on people for the specific purpose of blackmailing people. And remember, this is a guy that's still held in high esteem in the FBI. They've named their building after him. He's nothing but a common blackmailer. And so if the head of the FBI can do it, well, an intelligence agency can do it also. And so that's important speculation that I think needs to be explored. And that's something else that I think Congress should get into, because if you got an intelligence agency that's doing what J. Edgar Hoover did, that's not a good thing with respect to a free society. Now, on the conspiracy theories on how he died and so forth, I don't know. I mean, you know, they've got an autopsy that says he got hung. But let's face it. I mean, to me, it's possible to hang a guy and you know, hold two burly guys, hold him up, and put a noose around his neck and drop him from a bunk bed and so forth. Did that happen? I don't know. But I'll tell you one thing. It was in a lot of people's interest that he exit this world either through suicide or through murder. And my hunch is that maybe when they saw that he had a proclivity to commit suicide, they just sort of looked the other way and said, "Well, let him go." But you know, I don't think anybody's going to get very far by insinuating murder, because once the autopsy came out, unless somebody were to go state's evidence or go public and say, "Yeah, we killed the guy," which is not going to happen. I think we have to just settle for the fact that it was a suicide.
Yeah. It's a separate question and a separate kind of entertainment to me, the way the media just immediately went on this jihad to essentially say you are forbidden from believing that maybe this guy was murdered. It couldn't be, and if you think so, you're one of those crazy people who we all despise and would never invite to our barbecue. Like, really? What a conspiracy theory that this guy who was clearly involved in the sexual blackmail of numerous powerful men mysteriously died in his cell mysteriously, but whatever, only a kook would think that it wasn't a suicide. Why? Simply because TV insists. That's it. Even though, essentially, it's just as plausible that he was murdered, and it's almost as plausible that he's still alive, and that they murdered some schmuck. And, you know, why not? This guy's pretty connected, seems like. It's just a speculation. You don't have to believe in that. But to think that, oh yeah, no, there's a 99.999% chance that it was suicide, and anybody else who thinks anything else is a horrible, terrible, crazy person. The kind of person who might have told you that the media was covering for this guy all along. Like, for example, when the National Review and the Huffington Post ran giant puff pieces by his paid PR people to rehabilitate his reputation after his conviction and so-called time served down there in Florida. That sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory too, that this guy wasn't completely hung out to dry 20 years ago by all of our hard-hitting investigative news reporters, the same ones who are telling us that we're horrible, stupid, crazy people now for even entertaining the possibility that whether Clinton or Trump or somebody we've never heard of would have had this guy whacked in his cell.
My reaction on the mainstream press was exactly like yours. I mean, I was amazed. I mean, investigative reporters are supposed to be skeptical of official accounts. And when he supposedly committed suicide, right when the announcement was made, you're right. The assessment of the mainstream press was, oh, this was clearly a suicide. Oh, the conspiracy theorists are already coming out. Well, nobody really knew at that point. I mean, it would be justifiable to be skeptical, especially for the media to be skeptical. That's their job, to say, you know, did anybody have a motive to get rid of this guy? Is it possible that some people are paying big money to snuff this guy out before he gets to trial and start spilling the beans? But you're right. It was all this, oh, conspiracy theorists are coming forward. Conspiracy theorists are coming forward, rather than express the skepticism that should be expressed. And you can see it in the same thing with respect to this point that I was making about the intelligence agencies. I don't see the mainstream press making a big deal out of that. And that's not a conspiracy theory, because Acosta himself says something about intelligence. That's something that all they got to do is subpoena him and say, what did you mean by this? And right. Who told you that intelligence had an interest in how this thing is resolved? And then he says, well, somebody told me this. All right, subpoena him until you get to the bottom of this. But I don't see the mainstream press talking about this at all.
Right.
At least not that angle.
Right. Or, you know, it's there, right? You can read it in the Daily Beast, but it's not the major part of the narrative, even though, of course, that's the juiciest tidbit out of all of it. Never mind any of the sex. Did somebody say he belongs to intelligence? Well, let's parse that. Dive in, somebody with a badge, right? Subpoena, bring together a grand jury. And I love the way you describe, I mean, just now you kind of alluded to it, but in the article, you have this great kind of daydream about what if America had a rule of law at all, and what if Congress actually would do such a thing as subpoena Acosta and nail him down on this point and make him name the guy who said that to him, and then bring that guy in and say, all right, buddy, now who told you to say that? And on down the chain until you get to the bottom of this corruption and make sure that the law still reigns supreme in America. This kind of ridiculous. Think of how far off of reality that is. And can you imagine Congress doing anything of the sort ever?
Well, no, because as I put at the end of my article, an agency that has enough power and influence to corrupt the federal judiciary has more than sufficient power to corrupt Congress. I mean, let's face it. Remember when Schumer made that Congressman Schumer made that remark that when Trump took on the intelligence agencies, he better watch out because they know how to retaliate 10 times to Sunday or something.
Yeah, six ways from Sunday of getting right. back at you.
Well, Congress knows that. Schumer knows it. Schumer's essentially expressing the sentiments of every member of Congress. They're scared to death to take on the CIA. And some of them are indirect assets of the CIA, sort of self-appointed assets and supporters of the CIA. So that's why you don't see anybody in Congress doing what I think they need to be doing, and that is subpoenaing Acosta and getting to the bottom of this intelligence relationship that Epstein apparently had. The CIA, I think, controls that type of thing. They wouldn't permit it to happen. They would not permit Congress to have this type of investigation. That's how much power I think they have in this country.
Yeah. Well, hey, Chuck Schumer's the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. I mean, that's about as powerful and influential as you can get. And in fact, in that clip, I'd have to go back, but I'm not so sure that he's delivering a threat on their behalf. It seems more like just honest advice from the majority leader in the Senate to the incoming president that, hey, man, these guys are gangsters. Hell, you should really watch your step.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I think he was just making an honest assessment of the situation that, hey, Trump, don't be stupid. That any president that takes on the national security establishment, they're going to come after you and you're going to pay a big price for it.
Yeah, and he wasn't addressing some congressman-elect. He was addressing the president-elect. That, hey, we all know who's the real boss around here and it ain't you.
And right.
Yeah. And what I like about that, too, is that he said that on Rachel Maddow's show. And she's like, yeah, Like, this is not a topic to explore that. Wow, I mean, what are you really saying here, Senator? You know, that Langley is more powerful than Capitol Hill?
Well, that raises
then the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue? Really?
I don't have any doubts that it is the most powerful branch of the government. We don't think in terms of the national security establishment being a separate branch, but it really is. And there's a great book called Double Government by a guy named Michael Glennon, mm-hmm. who's professor of law at Tufts University. That's his thesis in this book, that the national security branch of the government is the most powerful branch. And it makes sense because government is force. So the other three branches may have a U.S. Marshal or a DEA or some agricultural official carrying a gun, but that's not real force. Real force is troops, bullets, planes, ships, and that's the national security establishment. And Glennon's thesis is that they're the ones really running the show, and they permit the other three branches to have a veneer of being in charge, but because they don't care about the appearance. All they care about is, are they calling the shots under the table? And Glennon's book is really worth reading. It's the best analysis I've seen of the deep state ever, and it's done in a very scholarly, credible way.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because people say the deep state this or this kind of state that, but if you go back to Albert J. Nock and his book, it's a short book or essay, Our Enemy, the State, he defines the state as different from the government. The government is sort of, you know, the buildings, the institutions, the laws, and the offices. Kind of, but the state is the interlocking web of community among the human people who occupy those buildings and offices and wield those powers. And that's not just exactly the bureaucrats themselves, but that's, of course, completely intertwined with all of their special interests. As broadly defined as you can make it, that is the deep state, of course, is the CIA and all their contractors and all their contractors and the CIA both ways.
Yeah, I mean, that's a point, as you know, that I've been making for many, many years, that I favor a limited government republic. That is what our country was founded on, and that it got converted to a national security state after World War II. And a lot of Americans think, oh, it's just the same governmental system we've always had. It really isn't. It's a totally opposite type of governmental system. A national security state is a totalitarian type of government structure, and it is the opposite of a limited government republic. And so we've ended up with a government with the power to assassinate people, including Americans, torture people, including Americans, indefinite detention, secret prison camps, coups, alliance with the dictatorial regimes. This was no part of the governmental system on which America was founded. So what I say is just dismantle this thing and restore a limited government republic to our land. It's a necessary prerequisite to being free. Now, does that scare people? Oh, yeah, because they've all grown up with the CIA and the NSA and the Pentagon. They think, oh, you know, everybody's coming to get us, and I want to be kept safe. And it's a classic case of trading liberty for the pretense of security. Because what ends up happening is you end up not only with a tyrannical government with these omnipotent powers like assassination and torture and so forth, but you've given up both your freedom and your security. You end up with neither.
Yeah. Well, and that's where we are right now.
Exactly.
All right, you guys, that's Jacob Hornberger. He may or may not be running for the candidacy of the Libertarian Party for president of the United States next year. And I guess we'll find out at some point. He's also the founder, the president of the Future Freedom Foundation, and he's written 10,000 articles up there, maybe 20,000 since like 1989, I think. FFF.org/blog. Thanks very much, sir.
Oh, Scott, it's always an honor and a pleasure. Thank you very much, and thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate it. And if anybody wants to learn more, come to FFF.org. We've got a free daily publication that we strive to make the best libertarian commentary page on the internet. And that's at FFF.org.
Absolutely. And you can subscribe, too, to the Future Freedom. It's not called it's just called the Future Freedom now.
Yeah,
the monthly.
That's our monthly journal. That costs $25 or $15 for the email version. And then you can also send us a donation, because that's, what, of course, how we survive is we live off the donations that people send us.
Yeah.
So thank you, Scott. We're very, very appreciative for every time you have me on the show. I'm honored and grateful.
All right. Good deal. Good to talk to you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, you guys, that's FFF.org. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.